Good morning. This is Robert J. Sawyer, and you are listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'll see you in the future.
At Irregular Hours, episode 147 for January 19th, 2021. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Vidor.
And we are streaming into the future with Flash Forward, the 1999 wonderful science fiction, the most science fiction novel that we've had so far on this show. Robert J. Sawyer, boy, what a fun interview that was last week.
Oh, it really was. It was so much fun to re-listen to. I realize I'm going to be quoting that interview in a book I'm writing right now about Canadian crime fiction. I thought Sawyer had such great insights into what's different about science fiction and fantasy. And his point, which I've noticed many times, that most sci-fi fantasy readers have a really strong preference for either fantasy or science fiction, but that a lot of sci-fi readers also really like detective fiction. I thought he did a wonderful job of explaining, as a writer, exactly why that is. And so I loved everything about the interview, but that was the part that really stayed with me.
Well, and what I learned, of course, is that some people just say so much more with their words. Truly a very insightful, a very thoughtful person. What a wonderful opportunity to get in the inside of a mind of a writer. And this story is a perfect representation of the type of material that he likes to explore in his mind. And obviously, he's very good at putting it on paper.
It's great to talk to the authors. I am so happy that we've had the opportunity to talk to the authors for so many of these books. It's important to know the context from the author. Even though Pam doesn't like to think of the author as a part of the story, she likes to go just, this is a story, it was presented in this format. I love having these conversations. I look forward to some further interviews in the future.
I actually love talking to authors, and I think we learn so much from them. But as a critic, I actually don't necessarily weigh the author's analysis more than any other analysis. Mm. So that's new criticism. It's just an approach to literary scholarship, is that I really think that, like, once you have a text, the author's analysis of that text has to be backed up just the same as any other critics. The author can't be like, oh, here's what I meant. It's like, no. How did people read it? And so if a reader reads something differently than the author meant it, I'm going to go with the reader on that. So, which doesn't mean I don't want to talk to the author. I want both.
The person who experienced it has a lot more weight at this once it's released.
Well, and I think when you write something and you put it out in the world, it's not yours anymore. Mm-hmm. It becomes an object of popular consumption, and then how it gets consumed is going to change over time, and you no longer control it.
So what's the point of reading a novel whose ending has already been written? That's the quote that
it's the greatest quote, right?
Yeah, this is an interesting section of this book where we talk about the idea of fate and the idea of how much choice do we have as humans in this world.
Insight from Lloyd.
It's just pronounced Lloyd. He does in this section say, my name is Lloyd, with double L at the front.
Double L when he spells it out for those Europeans.
And I was thinking of you, Chip, when that part of the book came up.
I just want to thank the Lego movie for bringing that to our attention.
So guys, this idea about, is the future already written? Do we live in a world in which we have fate? If we figure out how to time travel, is that going to teach us that the future is already written? It's such a great question. And I want your perspectives on this because I have my own, but I'd love to hear what you guys think on this question of fate versus free will and time. What time travel does, what it teaches us.
Well, I'm going to say what I think the author was doing is initially that first part that we're reading about fate, they took it as this is the future and you can have no impact on it. But later on, it kind of liberalizes a little bit, and maybe it isn't. the we get questioned. I think that there's the skill of the story, is we take it as an absolute early on, and later on, yeah, maybe it is or maybe it isn't. But I do think this is a beautiful exploration of whether life is free will, as in I have impact on it, or whether, you know, it's the Matrix and I have no impact on it at all. I'm basically on a ship and it's going to go someplace, and it doesn't matter what I do, I'm going to arrive where, you know, they've told me I'm going to arrive.
And the other possibility in time travel is the idea of multiple universes, where there is a path where these things happened, and then there's another path where the opposite things happen. The infinity of different possibilities. Every human choice opens up another universe where the opposite choice is taken. And I love where he goes with that theory in this book, where he says, if that is the right theory, then there is no choice. And the other character says, oh, what do you mean there's no choice? Either you go left or you go right. He says, no, if in another universe, the other me chose to go right, I have no choice but to go left. That is brilliant idea of multiple universe theory.
Sawyer brings up in the writing, the philosophical, I don't know, puzzle where a cat is placed in a box. Does the cat...
Schrodinger's cat, yes.
Yeah. Where, you know, is cat living or is it dead? You know, eventually you open it up and in one situation it's living and the other one it's not there.
But until you open it up, until you observe it, it is both living and deceased. That superposition of quantum realm, before it's observed, it's both, which is mind-boggling to the human mind. We can't imagine that, but that's the idea of quantum phenomena.
Many years ago, there was the movie Mystery Men, where the guy was invisible as long as no one was looking at him. That was his power.
Mm-hmm. So, I like that. What's your position on all this, Pam?
Well, so here's the thing. So right now, I'm going out on a limb here, but I feel like right now we're in a moment around temporality that we were at in the early 80s around gender. And let me explain what I mean by that. So in the early 80s, we started to get within literary scholarship, the study of queer studies, which was claiming this word queer, which had long been used in a derogatory way to actually celebrate alternate sexualities. And in 1988 or 1990, Judith Butler wrote a book called Gender Trouble, in which she argued that we really need to think about not only gender. We had this distinction, sex, that's male, female, biology. You can just, there's two options. Or gender, that's a much more fluid space where we look at the social construction of sex. Judith Butler said, no. Sex also is a social construction. And when she said that in 1990, that was really hard for people to wrap their minds around. And I was reading that stuff in the late 90s when I was doing my graduate work. And it was kind of like a mind bend. Like, I mean, how, come on, you've got a penis or a vagina. What's in between that? But today, like, that is so easy to understand. I mean, kids today are so familiar with gender transitions that, like, my, you know, 9 and 12 year olds have, that's super easy to understand that gender itself is a social construction. So we have the A theory and the B theory of time, and long have, but quantum physics really changes our view of time. So the A theory of time is that the past is immutable. It's done. The present is right now what we all agree on. And the future, it may be done or it may be decided or it may not be, but either way, we can't know it, right? The B theory of time is a more cyclical notion, that time isn't just this line, it's something else. And we don't quite know what, but something else. And sometimes I wonder, and maybe this is fanciful on my mind, but I wonder if 30 or 40 or 100 years from now, people look back at us today and are like, oh my gosh, they had so much trouble understanding how time really works. That's so cute. The way that we might look back at our younger selves and be like, how did we not realize that gender was a social construction? So I kind of feel like when I read science fiction like this and a lot of science fiction and fantasy that thinks about temporality, I'm really curious where our philosophy of time and our science of time is headed.
I read a lot of science fiction. I read a lot of time travel. It is my favorite of the subgenres. And I enjoy the idea that time is an illusion and lunchtime doubly so. That's Douglas Adams, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. In addition to that, the Doctor Who says timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly ball of stuff. It's not a line that goes from point A to point B. You can jump around between all of these phrases of time. But in that science fiction of Doctor Who, there are certain things that cannot be changed. There are moments that are locked in. And
there are still immutables in the universe. Mm-hmm. And within The Good Place, we have the notion of time of Jeremy Baramy, which is the idea that if you look at how time works, it spells in really awkward cursive writing the word Jeremy Baramy.
Love that show. Good Lord, that's some good writing on that show. The idea of time is something that we certainly struggle with as humans that have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And we explore these ideas, and there's so many different possibilities in this book, in Flash Forward, for explaining what it was that this phenomena brought them.
Well, in that first part, I used the poem, I guess, that became the song O Fortuna, where it's this dogmatic march of time that is constantly bearing down on you. And eventually, you know, you wind up in death. And especially if you have misfortune, which is what this is kind of talking a little bit about there. But initially, you know, Sawyer's story talks a little bit about where people are really struggling because they know their future, and they're trying to figure out, they know where they are today, and there's this point in the future where they won't exist, or where they know they're going to wind up. How do they to get to that? And I mean, what do we have? We have the couple that's debating whether they should get married or not, knowing that he will be with someone else later on. We've got a person who is murdered, and he is trying to figure out, all right, so who did this? You know, do I have children? Do I have a wife? I mean, this is certainly is a wake up moment of, you know, where, you know, what am I doing today? And you know, this is where I'm going to be in the future. Why, I guess, how should I conduct myself between this moment and that moment is really coming down. I mean, kind of some of the exploration that Sawyer's talking about.
And one of the better stories of that question mark is the question of this relationship between the young scientist and this very attractive woman who he met before, but he sees in this future that they have a very passionate relationship in a lab, and he calls her up and asks to meet her on a real level because they have this connection potentially in 21 years. And that is so well put together.
Is it potentially? I mean, as it's presented, it is a fact. Mm-hmm. And if this moment in the future is a fact, why don't we just go ahead and get together right now?
Right. That's how that part of the story goes. But then we've got Theo and his brother. Theo's brother is very angry at Theo for being a part of this experiment that exposed his future, and he doesn't like his future. He doesn't like his future so much that he decides he can't go on with his current life because it goes nowhere, and he decides to commit suicide. So that changes that conversation of free will versus fate.
This is where they didn't bring in cryogenics, but it'll come in later.
Ooh.
Well, and I think part of what Sawyer is doing here is just showing that your concept of temporality is really going to impact how you behave in the face of having some sort of future knowledge, because different people take completely different. I mean, like Lloyd, just take Lloyd and Theo, our two scientists. Lloyd is like, well, I guess 21 years from now, I'm going to be with someone else. So why would I get married if I'm going to have to get divorced? And Theo's like, ooh, 21 years from now, I'm going to be murdered. So I'm going to do everything I can not to be where I'm going to, you know, to change the future rather than to accept and work towards it.
And some great conversations about exactly those choices. Like, it would be so easy if you saw yourself in 21 years at a certain place, just make a note and don't go to that place and you've broken the cycle.
Right.
Well, and but you think that's easy, but the discussion is that may not be easy. You may wind up there anyway.
We've read a lot of science fiction books in which people ended up at that horrible place they weren't going to be.
And it was of their own doing. And it was that twist of fate that made them go to that place because that's the way it was going to go.
And that's where they already were when this happened.
The things that we know, there's actuaries for, it's like that. We learned that the life insurance companies filed for bankruptcy. We learned that, was it sports betting? Certainly, you know, what's the point in competing if you know what the results are going to be? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of little stuff going on in the background that you're picking up too.
You should ask the Chicago Bears that. Sorry. All of these ideas are so well spelled out here by Sawyer. I'm so glad that we're reading this. And Pam, you're right. Science fiction is certainly a great way to explore this. And Sawyer, I agree with you, is one of the better science fiction writers that we've ever read.
Absolutely. And if you guys want to come back and read one of his other 23 novels, we can do that in the future, because they're all so different from one another. That's what I especially admire about his writing. Now, remind me, did you guys watch the ABC television adaptation from 2009 of Flash Forward?
I've seen a few episodes, probably 3 or 4 of the 22 episodes.
It's television. No.
Chip doesn't watch television. It's beneath him.
So I just started rewatching it. I watched it when it came out because, of course, I enjoyed the book so much. But it's really interesting because I'm just very annoyed as I'm watching it because I think it's very, very good. And I cannot believe that they canceled it before revealing where they were going with it. But they changed 3 big things from the novel. So the protagonists are 2 FBI agents instead of these 2 physicists. Now, the physicists exist, but our main perspective is through FBI agents. And they really double down on that detective sci-fi combination that Sawyer talked about. So that was very logical to me. And hey, like, come on, way more people watch crime shows than shows about scientists in labs. That's just the reality.
Okay. We've got a test we've got to do to this week.
All right.
I know. Then we have Flash Forward is 6 months ahead instead of 21 years ahead, which again makes sense for television because you're not going to, you know, try and put people 21 years ahead. But here's the big difference. It's so dark. So within Sawyer's novel, and especially in the part that we read for today, lots of people reach out to Lloyd Simcoe after he makes that really, really bold and rather brave statement. We got to tell people about this. We can't have people worrying that it's going to happen again. So we have to tell people that we think that even though we couldn't have anticipated it, this is CERN's fault, that CERN's physics experiment is what actually created this problem. And a lot of people reach out to Lloyd Simcoe and are like, hey, you know what? That Flash Forward was really helpful to me. Like, it helped me to see this or that. And they actually talk about catharsis within the novel, about the idea that when you have something this gigantic, this catastrophic, because millions of people die during the Flash Forward from everyone blacking out at once, you also get some sort of benefit. And Theo explains this. He said it's because of the catharsis. I tell you, good old Aristotle knew exactly what he was talking about. You give people a chance to purge their emotions and they actually end up more healthy after it. So many people lost someone they cared about during the Flash Forward. The outpouring of grief has been very good psychologically. And this is an idea that comes back to Aristotle, as Sawyer helpfully points out. He's a little bit of a teacher as he writes his novels. And this is an idea behind, like, what is the use of art in a society? is that it's a way for audiences to get catharsis, to process grief and anxiety. And boy, oh boy, the TV series is way, way, way darker than this and has none of that optimism that we were talking about with Sawyer that he absolutely said was at the basis of all of his novels.
But all right, so let's put it in context of 2007, 2008, when that was probably written. You know, yep. We're in the Great Recession, which, you know, arguably could be just called a depression. Certainly there were a lot of things that were people who were suffering at that moment. And so maybe it was a reflection, not of this book, but of the times it came out. The television show came out. I think that there's a lot to this. I'm thinking of a couple areas of it. Because in the book, we talk about people stopped going to therapists because they had had this moment and they've had this ability to purge these emotions. But I mean, maybe this is the benefit of crying, or the ability to experience sadness or the melancholy or whatever that moment is.
The expression, that idea of catharsis is right there, that expression of that emotion.
But I mean, it's the human experience that moves you forward. And Sawyer could have taken this in incredibly dark place, but he didn't do that. That's the thing I'm noticing also.
There's a good mix of the positive things that come out of this experience and the very dark experience that comes out of this. And he is exploring all of the gambit of human emotion here.
Right. And I think there's also the difference between a novel and a TV series. So all of that anxiety makes for like really good pacing on TV. Whereas when you're reading, you can pause and be like, oh, that's probably how it would be for me. When you read all of these different stories and you think, what would I see? You know? So there's a more sort of like that reader activism that sort of gets energized by a novel. Whereas sometimes when you're watching TV, you're just like, what's going to happen next?
Yeah, the adaptation. Have you ever read Stephen King's 11/22/63, Pam?
I haven't, and okay. It's on my list.
It is his only time travel novel, and it is extensive. It is detailed. The storyline, the protagonist goes through this months and months and months of activity, and when they adapted it into a Hulu series, it took, you know, a much shorter amount of time because of the compacting of the idea. And yeah, it takes out a lot of that emotion, a lot of that thinking about how would I react in this situation. So I admire that they took this concept and put it into a TV show. And the idea of the investigators being FBI agents instead of scientists does make a lot of sense. This, we are looking at a lot of investigatory things that scientists maybe wouldn't really be a part of, but it works in the science as well.
Right. And then the other question, and this is a really open one, and I don't know, but I guess after our interview, I mean, is there a little more optimism in the Canadian perspective than in the American perspective? And this...
Yes.
It's cold up there.
Next question.
But I do feel like when you look at, you know, The Walking Dead, I mean, there's a dark view of how humanity would act. And in the opening scene of the ABC, when they show the flash forward, they're in LA and they show people looting like 2 minutes after the blackout. And none of that's in the novel. Like 2 minutes after the blackout, everyone's trying to help someone that they see is in need.
Yeah. And
that also could be Hollywood's flavor, take on how they think society works.
And back to your point earlier, 2009, when this adaptation came out, was a very different time in our society than it was in 1994. And the dark place that we were at with the economy, with all sorts of things happening, that is reflected in the literature of that time.
Sure.
So there's more to it than just the difference between Canada and the United States.
Absolutely. And I'm not putting that. Yes. But I'm not even sure how much of a difference there is.
If Steve can speak for all of Chicago now.
It was a bleak time in our history. Let me explain. But he does go into some of his really interesting predictions, not only for the future of 2030, but the future of 2009 in this section. There's some very interesting things that that Sawyer brings here.
I found chapter 15 really, really fun to read. Like, he suggests that Queen Elizabeth will die in 2017 and the English monarchy is dissolved. So, as we know, Queen Elizabeth is very much still with us.
Yeah, but the state of the monarchy is really in flux right now. So he was not far off on that one.
We did have a couple renounce their ties to the monarchy.
Yep. And move to Canada.
Now, I love that when he starts saying, like, the world is different in 2030, here's how, here's the things that they learn from putting all the flash forwards together. He starts with the English monarchy. Then he says, oh, Quebec is still part of Canada. Like, as if anybody outside of Canada would care about that.
Were following that. I was like, oh, well, thank goodness.
That was a moment when he was writing this. There was certainly a movement.
But it's also, it's very Canadian content, right? Okay. he talks about South Africa. He says no one's been to Mars yet. I loved reading in 1999 his very good prediction that the U.S. has had an African-American male president, but still not a woman president.
Yep, right on.
That was right on.
1 point for Sawyer.
How interesting that would be, you know, if you had to place your bet. I mean, there's going to be, absolutely, within a lifetime, there will be a woman president, if not multiple women presidents.
Okay. Put that money down, Chip. We'll see what happens.
I guess it depends how long we live, my friend. The Catholic Church ordains women, which hasn't happened, but is definitely a possibility.
That's a conversation that's been had for a generation, though. So
I was going to say, a lot of the Protestant churches, that is very much just part of what they do now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That China would be the last communist country, but that would be completely committed to and thriving in communism. That's pretty interesting. He does predict that the ozone depletion has got a lot worse. And I loved reading that because it made me feel so optimistic, because sometimes I get really down about climate change and how little attention we're paying. But we did have a huge ozone problem, and we did take care of it through a combination of technology and social behavioral change. So maybe there's optimism to be had when it comes to our giant existential problem of global climate change.
I agree. I liked the message there that we did overcome the ozone problem, even though in 1994, from his perspective, he thought it was going to do nothing but get worse. So yes, I caught that as well.
Now, the idea that cars now hover, so you don't need pavement, you can build new green belts. I don't think we're very close to that. But boy,
GM just introduce a flying car? I want to say Cadillac this week or something.
We are right on. The CES happened this week, the Consumer Electronics Show, and I didn't go because nobody went because it was all virtual this year. But I did get to see some of the presentations. And yes, the new GM quadcopter big enough to carry a person was officially introduced as a concept. We're still at the concept stage, but we are right on the cusp of that concept of flying cars, finally.
Well, George Jetson has promised us that for many, many years.
That's right.
But here's the thing. We're at driverless cars. Like, we're very, very close to the full rollout of driverless cars, whereas we're not nearly as close to hovering. And in science fiction, hovering has been around forever, as you just noted, Chip, whereas there's been maybe even much less attention to driverless, which is where we've gone in real life.
And in real life, we're going to have to get to the driverless first before we get to flying, because the AI, the computer, will have to do the flying. Otherwise, there was going to be some terrible tragedies.
Now, and then another prediction that jumped out at me was the one that Donald Trump was building a pyramid in the Nevada desert to house his eternal remains. When done, it will be 10 meters taller than the Great Pyramid at Giza.
Right. So are you telling me that when this book was written, he understood that Donald Trump has a big ego?
Yes.
I think it's a possibility.
Home Alone 2 came out in 1992. So when Sawyer was writing this book that came out in 1999, Donald Trump was already well known for his personality, and we should have seen the rest coming.
The art of the deal.
Oh, boy.
So anyway, I always enjoy reading novels, you know, that are a few years old. This one's 21, 22 years old. And looking at how their predictions come out, these ones were, I would say, pretty accurate overall.
And I love the toss-off notion that Christ has not come again. And it reminds me so much of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. They travel to the end of the universe, and the silly announcer says, well, if your savior's going to arrive, he better arrive pretty quickly. And then the savior arrives and says, did I miss anything? It's very humorous.
So now, within this part of the novel, we have the notion that Machiko brings up, hey, maybe we should repeat the experiment. And so, obviously, we still have a third of this book to go. But at this moment, as you're reading for the first time, does this feel like a good idea? Do you think it's a plausible one? Would people agree to repeat such an experiment?
That's an incredibly interesting question, because the first experiment certainly was not, it did not mean to have such a negative response. And people died. A lot of negative things happened. And I just couldn't imagine just saying, you know what? I know a lot of people died. Well, I mean, this is certainly, I'm going to make sure I'm clear on this, on such a massive level. This wasn't an automobile that the driver died, a single driver, or a rocket where we lost a crew. This is where, you know, thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people died, perished, or killed.
Millions. Suffered in some millions. Way.
Mm-hmm. It just seems like, how could we even do it again? Even if we
but that's
control.
How science works.
Exactly.
That's how science works. You wouldn't just do it once and go, this is the way that it will always go. You have to prove or disprove it. And I love how he lays this out, saying, if we can prove that it wasn't our fault, that it's not going to happen again, people can feel better about their day, not having this thing hanging over their head. What's going to happen? Is it going to happen again?
Then Sawyer's missing the number of lawsuits they're going to bankrupt this company as they just try to defend themselves, because
that is certainly
there's no way they would have the resources. All they would be able to hire is attorneys. And they would, you know, if there was any type of bankruptcy or whatever, and they would go after these people personally.
But just coming out to say that we think maybe we might have been the cause of this, that would have triggered so many lawsuits. And that is brought up in this story.
Oh, yeah, that part is brought up. But I just think that the years that they would take to be able to replicate this, it would just be tied up in court. They would never be able to do it, in my opinion.
This is Canada. They'll just ask nicely.
It's Switzerland.
They'll just send some chocolate.
Noted to be, you know, never taking sides on things. So interesting.
So, well, yeah, but I mean, I don't know. I guess I totally hear what you're saying, Chip. But at the same time, I feel like if you did have a situation like this, you need to get to the bottom of it. You need to know how it happened so that people can live their lives, understand how to process it, but also not be terrified all the time that it's going to happen again.
Sure.
And so I'm not as sure that people wouldn't do like a really controlled second experiment. I don't know. I think it's possible, because that's the only way you're going to learn. Like, you need more data. So, I mean, they've been analyzing the data that they received from this experience. Now you just need more data in order to actually have a good theory.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but the fear of the unknown is, for me, far more frightening than the fear of something that I know is going to happen. I don't know if you lived through 2020, but the idea of not knowing is absolutely terrifying.
Not knowing what?
Everything. I want to know everything. I want to know what's going to happen. And since I can't possibly know what's going to happen, I sometimes dwell on the idea of what can I do to protect myself and my family from the possibilities. And the possibilities are endless.
Steve, you watched The Simpsons for how many years now? You know they get the predictions for the future.
Right, they're fine. We're fine. Just watch The Simpsons. Denver Broncos.
So, guys, as we wrap up this middle episode, and we'll finish this novel for next week, what do you guys think caused the flash forward? We've had now several different possible suggestions.
The one that we haven't talked about yet is the idea of the simulacrum. This idea of maybe, just maybe, what we saw in these visions of 2021 are not real. It's just a simulation that we are living in.
Ooh, I don't think Michiko, though, I don't think she thinks we're living in the simulation, although that would be an interesting idea, too. She actually just suggests that in the future, someone might have put together AI computing that actually creates a simulation of everyone's minds and memories and then projects it out. And that's what we suddenly got a flash of access to.
Okay, so not living in, but experiencing, whatever right. The experience of being in that moment in 21 years.
That's touching an AI projection. Each of us got an AI projection of our own futures.
And so Elon Musk will agree with that. Mm-hmm. That certainly is something that he's thrown out there, that this is a simulation. And obviously anybody who's seen The Matrix has experienced some form of this. And I'm speaking to you in particular, Mr. Anderson.
And we've talked about this so many times on not necessarily this show, but the other show. Remember the other show? We talked about the singularity, the idea that there is a moment in computing that we could theoretically simulate a human brain, and we could theoretically, in the not too distant future, take the consciousness from a human and install it in this computer, and therefore, like the Matrix, have this life that we live without the corporeal part of it, just the intellect.
What was an Amazon series that explored this, the comedy series that we watched?
Yes, just last year, The Upload is the name of that one.
Yes, and it was excellent. And I had a very annoying experience where my Netflix told me, wouldn't you love to watch the upload, which I already did. And I was like, oh, season two must be ready. But no, they were just like, wouldn't you love to rewatch something you just watched 6 months ago?
The tease of Netflix.
I want season two.
Yeah, season two is definitely pre-written. The person who wrote this, Greg Daniels from The Office, wrote this as a two-season exploration of consciousness and reality. And season one ends on a big cliffhanger. So yes, I am ready for a season two of Upload as well.
Excellent.
All right, well, let's find out. Let's find out what the explanation might be.
So what do we need to do to prepare for next week?
Finish this book. Read through to the end. See what happens. I can't wait to hear what you guys think about the ending.
Yeah, there's two foreshadowing things that I'm focusing on that I'm trying really hard not to focus on. And I have them in the show notes, but I don't want to ask because I know, Pam, that you've read this book. And so you could tell me if I was reading the foreshadowing correctly or not. But there are two distinct things that Sawyer puts into his writing that I am focusing on. Like, wait a minute, what is that thing that we're seeing in the future that could lead back to the solution to this mystery? I'm intrigued by this mystery. Thank you so much for bringing us this book, Pam.
Of course, and thank you for reading it. It's just been so much fun to talk about it, especially with Sawyer.
So that is our assignment. We are finishing this book next week, reading chapters 21 through 33, finding the solution, knowing the future, and not being bogged down by fate. It's fated that we will read the rest of this book next week. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week.
What do you think, Pam?
We must come back next week because we already did.
That's awesome. I want to thank everybody for listening. This has been great. We would love to hear from you. If you have questions, if you have answers, if you know something about our future that we don't know, give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4867. Our website is sandwichesatirregularhours.com. Our email is sandwichesatirregularhours@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and YouTube. The future is before us. I want to thank you again for listening to Sandwiches at Regular Hours. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflo.
And I'm Pam Bedard.
We're fated to see you in the future.